building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, everybody, to Peace Paradigm Radio, a project of the Meta Center for Nonviolence in collaboration with KWMR Community Radio. And I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and colleague, Michael Negler. Nonviolence is not the inanity it's been taken to be throughout the ages, as Gandhi said. There is a science behind it. There are strategies and techniques and principles and theory. There's a lot to discover that when we start getting in there. But one thing that often gets in the way is the way that nonviolence is reported or not reported in the news, and also the image of the human being that comes across in our media, which has plays such a big role in our lives. We are seeing, a survey says, close between 3,000 and 5,000 commercial messages a day of seeing, hearing, just taking it in wherever, unless we're living maybe deep in the heart of West Marin or an Occidental, you know. All of these things are telling us that we are separate material creatures destined to compete for scarce resources on a finite planet, because that's the kind of worldview that really helps to sell consumption. So starting with that, we're going to go ahead and turn to some nonviolence in the news with my colleague, Michael. So Michael, what's going on in the news today?
Oh, Stephanie, I'm afraid it's not very good. The planet just got more finite.
Oh, really? Why? Yeah. What?
Royal Dutch Shell oil rig did escape from the Kai activists in Seattle, and they're heading up to the Arctic to drill the heck out of that place. And the other, then in the Mediterranean, it looks like the flotilla is not going to make it into Gaza. So it looks like nonviolence doesn't work.
What? Wait a minute. Wait, I think that we should go ahead and bring on our special guest now, because the way you're reporting the news sounds very familiar. I'd like to bring in Mickey Huff, who's the director of Project Censored, and he's on the board of directors for the Media Freedom Foundation. He's currently professor of social science and history at Diablo Valley College in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he's co-chair of the history department. Huff is co-host with former Project Censored director Dr. Peter Phillips of the Project Censored Show, and this program airs weekly as part of the Morning Mix on Pacifica's KPFA Free Speech Radio in Berkeley, California, and rebroadcasts on several stations, including NoLiesRadio.org and the Progressive Radio New York Network out of New York City. So he's a pretty cool guy who's going to tell us a lot about where Michael started to go wrong with his news reporting right there. Welcome to the show, Mickey Huff.
Stephanie, Michael, thank you so much for having me on your program. It's been a while, and I'm glad we've been able to make this happen. Very excited about it, and definitely a supporter of what you all do at Meta Center.
Well, let's just get in there then, because, you know, Michael turned to the news and he started telling us, you know, nonviolence doesn't work, don't pay attention to it, there's really nothing we can do. So what do you think about that, and why does it inspire the work that you do?
Well, I think one of the points that underscores what Michael is getting at here is the way that a lot of news and information is framed is negatively, and it does focus on problems. It focuses on shortcomings. It may focus on failures or foibles. But at Project Censored, we, you know, for the last 39 years have tried to uncover and highlight and celebrate independent journalism that kind of counters, in many cases, the narratives of corporate news media. But we also try to unearth and highlight good news or positives type stories. Certainly a couple things that Michael was saying there don't sound great for those of us that are champions of social justice and trying to be stewards of the planet. But I think also the fact that the Kayaktivists were there and mobilized. That's the degree that they were. I think that's fairly heartening. I think that's pretty good news. And speaking of good news, right up in that neck of the woods is Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine, and highlighting a lot of positive news stories that go on. And Project Censored does the same. In fact, in every book, every year, we have at least one chapter, and we have many stories throughout the top 25 underreported stories that highlight some things that are happening that are good in terms of social justice. So, and I think that we could probably get into another discussion about framing and how we define censorship and look at propaganda. But I do think that, people, they kind of get used to the news being bad. And I think that that's a habit that's well worth breaking. And I think the way we do that is by helping people become more media literate and more self-empowered in terms of how they choose sources of information.
In fact, Mickey, I want to talk to you in a little while about Peter's two trainings that are coming up for that very purpose. But let's take that very example that I was so rightly cut off when I was trying to report on. The Kayaktivists are actually ecstatic about what happened up in Seattle Bay.
Indeed.
Because, first of all, they took lots of training. Second of all, they were thrilled with the way they were able to mobilize so quickly. That nobody got hurt. And while at the very end, the rig may have slipped out of the bay and given them the slip and is heading up to the Arctic Circle, it never was about this particular rig. It was about making more mainstream attention come to the death of the planet that's being caused by this, what's called extractivism. And they hit mainstream media outlets all over the world, except for some funny reason, not a whole lot in the United States.
No, Michael, that's correct. And in fact, at Project Censored, we don't really use the term mainstream media to refer to the ubiquitous, readily available media that people have on cable and so forth. We call it what we think is a more descriptive title. It's corporate media. And I think within that label, of course, that includes Fox and MSNBC, CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNBC. We also include NPR, PBS there because they're increasingly funded by private for-profit corporations under the aegis of public broadcasting. But they rarely report in the public interest. Neither does the corporate media, and that kind of is one explanation for why in the U.S. you won't see a lot of highlighting of that story of challenging fossil fuel industry to at least slow down the pace of destroying our ecosystems. And I think that once people start to understand and become more media literate and understand the landscape of our news media, we can understand more clearly why we're delivered such relentless propaganda, and we can actually do something about it. And I think that's very positive and very proactive. And we can also help turn each other on and our own communities on to other places to get information and hear other critical perspectives, like the one you just gave about the Kayaktivists, Michael.
Right. And Meta's role in all of this is to actually help build that new framing. And as you probably are aware, Mickey, we have this concept of work versus work, meaning that in nonviolence, you don't just look at the immediate outcome. You look at the long term. You look at the changes that are slowly being worked in the culture. And from that point of view, the Kayaktivism was a huge success. And not only that, but the flotilla, there's another flotilla that's heading for Gaza right now. And even the members, the crew members, are saying getting into Gaza and delivering this humanitarian aid would be nice, but it's never what we were about. And the Israelis are saying, well, this is just a publicity stunt. And the sailors are saying, exactly, it's to get publicity, to draw publicity to the fact that Gaza is the world's largest outdoor prison and that there's an illegal blockade going on. So training people to be sensitive to the finer points of how nonviolence works is a big part of our picture, I think.
I think so. And Andy Lee Roth, our associate director, and I we're just finishing Censored 2016 right now, Media Freedom on the Line. It'll be out this fall. And, you know, one of the things that we were noting that's related to what you just said is that over a decade ago, you know, the media scholar Robert McChesney recalled why the state of journalism and media literacy education really ought to be everybody's concern. And he noted that, you know, corporate news media, they're set up to maximize profit for a relative handful of large companies. And McChesney wrote that that system works well for them, but it's a disaster for the communication needs of a healthy and self-governing society. And so if we want to change the content and logic of the media, we have to change the system. And former FCC, Federal Communication Commissioner Nick Johnson, who's been a Project Censor judge since our founding in 1976, he put it this way. Whatever your first issue of concern, right, media had better be your second, because without change in the media, progress in your primary area is far less likely.
Yeah.
And so that kind of ties into these workshops you alluded to a while ago with President of Media Freedom Foundation Project and former Project Censor Director Peter Phillips. He's going to be conducting these educational workshops, you know, on how we be the media and how we be more critical of the news media we get. Because, for example, and you know this very well, and you framed it from the outset that at Meta Center, even though, you know, you have this prime objective of nonviolence, nonviolence education, you also have the challenge of getting that philosophy recognized and getting that out there in the world in from your own frame and perspective, not one that's winnowed or changed or altered or spun by others in corporate media that may take issue with that perspective.
Yeah, and, you know, I think about the way that, you know, where we're coming from at Meta Center is in relationship to the life and legacy of Gandhi in a lot of ways. And he, every time that he ran a campaign, every time, you know, that he set up a new living community, they would set up a printing press and he would have, you know, Young India going out. And he was always creating his own media to explain what was happening and having that deep interpretation of, you know, this is our opinion, because otherwise who can you rely on to tell that story if it's not you? But, you know, so I think that in a certain generation, you might find this with your students as well, that, you know, a lot of us are getting our news from the social media and the internet, which is in a way a great way to challenge the corporate media on the television sets. However, do you have anything to say about this idea of junk food media and the way that even, you know, the wonderful, I don't want to go there too much, but because I don't, but the, you know, the cats on social media and, you know, all of the little, you know, that kind of thing is keeping us from having real discussions about things that matter, or, you know, how do you see the junk food? What is junk food media that you guys call that? And how does it work even on social media?
Okay. A couple things there. That's a pretty deep topic. Overall, in fact, we joke, it's not a funny joke, but at the project, you know, we do this chapter on junk food news and news abuse every year, and it gets longer and longer, and it starts to take things over. And I've talked to our publishers at Seven Stories Press and said, look, we could have the whole book just be about this, but I don't want to give it that much attention, because it already gets far too much attention. And our founder, the Carl Jensen, who, sadly passed away a little over a month ago, almost 2 months ago now. He coined that term, junk food news, back in 1983, and because he was criticized by journalists. He came from a journalism background when he founded the project and at Sonoma State University, and people said, well, in journalism said, you know, Carl, we don't think there's censorship in the news media. It's news judgment. There's only so much time. Right, there's only so many column inches and so many minutes of broadcast. Well, Ted Turner came along and changed that right around that time with the advent of CNN and 24/7 news coverage. And Jensen referred to the increase in news coverage, news inflation, and stated that just because there's more of it doesn't mean it's better. The fact that there is more of it means that it seems to be worth less or worthless. And so he started to look at not just what the corporate news media were not covering, but what they were covering, right? And one of the first major junk food news stories actually dealt with junk food. Some of the listeners may remember Wendy's restaurant, Where's the Beef? The older lady that would come up and say, where's the beef? But that woman and that part of the advertisement ended up getting tons of attention, which, by the way, creates all kind of free advertising for, you know, Wendy's or other corporations. So it's a twofer in terms of corporate media and their profit-driven agendas. But the idea was is that Carl said they're spending way too much time covering things that absolutely have no bearing on our lives, whether it's O.J. Simpson's slow speed car chase or keeping up with the Kardashians. Mm-hmm. There's just no shortage of this. And social media, I think, for all of its positives, and I know Michael was also, I think, hinting around at some of this about the Kai activists, about what's happening in Gaza. A lot of us communicate with each other via social media, and these messages can spread virally in very positive ways for peace and to protest injustices. But they also mirror some of the worst tendencies in news media. And you mentioned the cat memes and so forth on social media.
I don't want to judge too much because it's not that they're not enjoyable.
We all have guilty pleasures. but the point is that the prime objective of news, technically, the free press system in the United States that was enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, that was designed to create an informed populace that was capable of self-governance. And so while we all have our other, interests and guilty pleasures and distractions, what happens when news media becomes one of the prime purveyors of these distractions? Well, what we get is a confused society, a distracted society. In some senses, we may get a jaded society. But the other flip side of that is, and this is what we promote at Project Censored, is, hey, wait a minute. Turn off the corporate news media and commercial news media momentarily and take a look at all the other independent journalists that are doing real free press work to protect things like due process and privacy rights and to protect the very principles, that are enshrined in the U.S. Constitution that we should do more than pay lip service to. And so by analyzing junk food news and what Peter Phillips later called news abuse, right, or literally propaganda, how an important story will come up, but the way the corporate media covers it, it kind of diverts away from the issue. Classic example unfolding right now is the roof, the terrorist shootings and killings, murders in the terrorist attacks in Charleston against African Americans. The most of the corporate news media were like, well, we can't use the word terrorist. We don't know what we're going to do here. And then it turned into a whole spinoff on why the Confederate flag needs to come down. And, okay, that's an important issue. And what the flag stands for historically is an important issue. But the racism behind those symbols is now sort of taking a back seat to that. And Al Sharpton said on Democracy Now! Just recently that he hopes that the taking down of the flags isn't just a changing of the curtains. He'd rather see the whole building, changed, meaning we have to really think about how our society has been structured, racially and in terms of power and in terms of who has power and who is powerless, who has voice and who is voiceless. And news abuse then is a kind of spin on news that prevents us from having these key dialogues with each other in the so-called corporate media sphere, and it turns it into other things that are mightily divisive, right?
Right.
And we think that that's something that if we have critical media literacy skills and we have a critically thinking public and we have a system set up whereby we're trying to help people understand how to navigate these landscapes, social media, et cetera, and otherwise, I think that we have a much better chance of creating the kind of world that we'd like to live up to, that more mirrors these principles we have in our nation's founding documents, and I would say globally, in things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And Article 19 of that document talks about the significance and importance of the right of expression, the right of people to be heard and to hear various perspectives and opinions. So news media is a very important part of these human rights.
And I also heard that during the Charleston debate about the flag, which, again, I think you got to the point that there are important points in there and that we take it seriously. But if it's used to divide us against each other, then we have to question it. But at the same time, legislation that's being covered in the news, legislation was passed in the Congress. Mm-hmm. That allowed for the fast track of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, happened during all of that debating about the flag. So we weren't paying attention to something that activists were otherwise very much following.
It's a classic bait and switch move. It is diversion. And I will argue, and I have argued, this is my seventh book with Project Censored now mm-hmm. this year, this is not accidental, and it's not coincidental. Now, that doesn't mean that the Obama administration orchestrated a false flag attack, as you'll hear at InfoWars or with Alex Jones or others. But what it does mean is that these people are very educated. They are very well aware of how media works, of how to manipulate public opinion. I mean, this has been going on for nearly a century now, dating back to Edward Bernays and the Committee on Public Information. I mean, this is a well-honed craft, that art of public relations. In the State Department, they actually call it public diplomacy. You know, the once upon a time word for it was actually propaganda.
Right, right.
But they are able to manipulate these situations, the establishment, to their benefit, and this is how TPP was able to basically slide through. And, of course, we have the Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage, and those people that support equality and equal rights are rightfully celebrating this. But, again, it's as if we can't walk and chew gum at the same time, right? It's as if, okay, we have this to celebrate, but meanwhile, what else is going on? And that's what the Junk Food News News Abuse chapter does in our books every year, is it says, while you were paying attention to this or that, here's three other things that were going on that also deserve our attention.
Can you give us a sense of some of the censored stories, since we only have a little bit of time left with you, some of the censored stories that made it into your 2015 book, and maybe one or two that you're looking at for 2016?
Sure. The we always have really fascinating stories every year. We have over a couple hundred that are investigated. We have over 200 students helping us research at about 20 campuses across the United States. And your listeners can go to projectcensored.org to find out all of our stories that we've done over the years. You know, one of the things, of course, we hit on last year was the fact that we lacked a national database on police killings and a lack of systems where we could hold police accountable for acts of violence. We had stories on big agribusiness silencing scientists that show herbicides cause cancer. We had a couple of good news stories, of course, also on restorative justice and how it's being used to turn violent schools around, right? So we covered these kinds of things. Our top story from 2015 was back to the issue of environmental concerns and planetary concerns. And that was ocean acidification, right? And it's a really huge phenomenon that's happening, and it threatens the lives of everything on the planet, to be quite frank. And I think that it's something that just gets short shrift. It doesn't get the attention that it really deserves. And for this cycle, for this year, we're Andy Lee Roth and I are just now putting together our next book, Censored 2016. A couple of the stories. One of the stories that I'm quite fond of, actually, for its significance in terms of free expression, is a story about how writers around the world are experiencing a chilling effect or a self-censorship effect because of the escalation and rise in violence against journalists, against writers, against people that speak out. And one of the stories that we're going to be, that we are looking at here this year is, that's something that we need to pay attention to. It is connected to how much we focus on the importance of free expression, the importance of free speech. And this is, of course, also connected to academic freedom, right? We see an onslaught, actually, against many professors that dare to speak unpopular truths. Professor Salita stands out at the University of Illinois in his tweets on Gaza or on Israel. Again, these are very important perspectives. In fact, sadly, we have stories on Gaza in the book every year. We had a Gaza water story last year and water shortage, only to have that story become, less important in the overall scheme of things, given Operation Protective Edge and the massive attack from the Israeli state on the Palestinian people. We're updating those stories this year. We have a deja vu chapter that goes back and looks at previously underreported stories to see what gets picked up. And sadly, the corporate media has spent almost no time dealing with the plight of Gazans, spent very little time trying to help people understand what's happening in the Ukraine, resorting to more of a Cold War anti-Russian kind of propaganda narrative, which is both simplistic and inaccurate. But again, these are the kind of things that we're looking at and we're covering. And we have multiple other chapters in the book every year, by the way, as well. Of course, Michael knows this. He had a chapter in our 2014 book, right. The New Story, right? Why we need one and how to create it. Mm-hmm. You know, exactly. Ultimately, that's what we're talking about at the project, is we do need new stories. We do need to hear people telling us what's going on around the world. And we need to also be part of that system of educating each other in respectful ways and opening pathways to dialogues, particularly with those among us where we find tension and disagreement. And I think one of the issues or problems I find with social media is, in terms of its algorithms, is it tends to feed people that which they seek out. And since many people have a propensity to seek out that which makes them feel reinforced or validated, we often don't, in our information habits, seek out diversity of viewpoints, seek out new and different information. And social media algorithms tend to feed our own worst, more narcissistic tendencies. And so I think that while all the good can be said about social media, one of the things we like to point out is that, again, back to media literacy, the more we help create an educated society, a society that is aware of media literacy issues, that is aware of a history and context of propaganda and information control, the more people can be in their own driver's seat as far as the information they seek out and be more aware that there are perspectives that go beyond that to which they're familiar or comfortable. And at Project Censored, that's one of the things that we really try to foster, is that kind of self-empowerment that people get from being aware, from being informed. And we really hope that that's what people take from our messages. We're on the air, on the radio, actually once a week at Pacifica and around the country, as you said. And these are the things that Peter Phillips and I try to get across to people. Peter does workshops, I teach, Nolan Higdon teaches, and we're spreading this critical media literacy program on over 20 campuses now. And again, that's the idea. Feminist anarchist Emma Goldman once said, "The most unpardonable sin in society is independence of thought." And what we try to do at Project Censored is really create a society that can think independently and that can be reasoned with, and we can engage it with each other in respectful discourse in hopes, as Michael was saying earlier, of creating really a better world, and not just one in the immediate future, but going back to the notion of indigenous peoples and seven generations, but really think long term about what's happening. What are we doing to the world, the environment? What are we doing to future generations of not just people, but just life on the planet itself? I think these are really important things. And I think that, again, we have our work cut out for us, but I think it's good work.
You're so right, Mickey.
We're up for the task, Michael.
We are. Nothing's going to stop us. As a distant relative of Emma Goldman, let me say that those critics of Carl Jensen were, in a sense, right. And, in fact, we are running out of time. So I want to ask you to make sure that our listeners hear this, to tell us how to get the books, Project Censored books, and also where and how to catch up with Peter's trainings. I think that's very important.
And you have 1 minute.
Okay. Unfortunately, I don't have in front of me exactly when Peter is doing what he's doing. However, if you go to projectcensored.org, you can find our radio shows there. You can get access to our film, Ending the Reign of Junk Food News. You can see all of our stories over the years, several independent studies and investigative reports we do that are both in the book and exclusive to the website. So basically, if you want to find out what's going on with Project Censored, go to projectcensored.org. If you happen to be in social media, we are on Facebook with 40,000 people, you know, on our page, and we highlight that and update that and put stories there every day, including events local and across the country, so people could go to the Facebook page to find out more about Peter's trainings as well.
Great. Well, Mickey Huff here on Peace Paradigm Radio, thank you so much for joining us. And if people want to get involved with what you're doing, they'll visit projectcensored.org and find out more.
Stephanie and Michael, thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for inviting me on the program.
You're very welcome, Mickey.
Yeah, hope to have you back.
Okay, great. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. We spent the first part of the show talking with Mickey Huff of Project Censored about the way that we need to cultivate media literacy in order to understand how media is being reported to us, why certain media is being reported to us, and to get behind the deeper principles behind the media. And so we're very lucky to have had him with us right before Michael now turns to his nonviolence in the news section. And so, Michael, before we get into the news, I want to, there was a question that I had wanted to talk to Mickey about, but since our limited time with having him at the first part of the show, we didn't get there. But I want to talk to you about, you know, he talked a lot about the corporate media. And the corporate media, insofar as it relates to the news, and insofar as the news can sometimes distract us with stories that are mainly there to divert our attention from what's going on so that other decisions can be made. But let's talk as well about the other kind of corporate media that there is, such as in the on television programs and films and that kind of corporate mass media that pervades our sense of culture and art in this country. Can you talk a little bit about what the connection is between what Mickey was talking about and the use of that kind of, you know, more artistic cultural media such as film, in particular, and television shows that seem to be dominating a lot of conversations these days?
I sure can, Stephanie. That's a fascinating topic that Mickey raised, and a fascinating question that you added on. I happen to have noticed a couple of examples that really almost shook me up a couple of days ago. I was seeing the newspaper of record, you know, the New York Times, and there was an article which had a photo of two 14-year-old girls reading a book which was highly touted, and people were lining up to buy this book. And this book was frankly, I mean, I'm not a prudish person, but this book was frankly pornographic. And there are things that are very harmful to feed into the mind of a young developing person, a sense of objectification of themselves, a sense that they have to please others and seek physical ways of relationship. And just the looks on those two girls' faces really, really saddened me. So I turned from that to a feature that I like to see every now and then, which is a director explaining how he had shot a particular scene in his movie. And I'm not going to mention who the director was or what the movie was, but the scene, the content of the scene, was young men viciously beating each other. And the director's report was 100% about the lighting, the background, the tempo, all these technical things, utterly ignoring the fact that these are human beings viciously beating each other. They're behaving like animals. In other words, what this does is...
Are they behaving like animals, Michael?
Well, thanks for catching me on that one. Actually, animals don't do that sort of thing. And that's part of the new science that's accompanying our new story that that Mickey spoke about. And I could talk at great length about how nice bonobos are. But I shouldn't have said that. But they're behaving in a vicious way. And it's being completely normalized by the fact that the director just glossing over it. Never mind what you're seeing. And this is a kind of cultural background for the political choices that Mickey was talking about, where you have important things going on, be they positive or negative, and the news media distract you. My only contact with the commercial mass media is really in the locker room these days. So I see a lot of athletics and the hysteria that accompanies sports. It reminded me of something that my hero Socrates said thousands of years ago. He said, you people ought to feed me and house me for the rest of my life, because these athletes that you pay so much attention to and you give so much kudos to, you make such heroes out of them, they give you the appearance of victory. Mm-hmm. I give you victory itself.
You know, and what I want to add to this, and sort of my sense of finding peace with this kind of ongoing comment that comes at us every time we tell people to unplug from the corporate mass media, where in particular I'm thinking of this other side of, quote, culture, that, you know, the films and the television programs and so forth. The news, the corporate news had always been just sort of a given for me. And I think a lot of people that we talk to have already started to interpret the news. So that was never my concern. But what I want to say about, you know, the television programs and films is that, you know, if we, our minds need to relax at some points. And I think that people turn to this kind of media for relaxation. And, but instead of finding actually, you know, the science will show, instead of allowing our minds and our bodies, therefore, to relax in these television programs and movies, what we find is that we're having the reactions of fight or flight, higher blood pressure, you know, all of the stress hormones are being released as we are turning toward those things that are supposed to, or that we feel that are probably relaxing us, which they're not. So if we really want to have more clarity around what the true story of the news is, what's, you know, really going on in society, how our issues that even, you know, quote unquote progressives are using are really dividing the conversation more than allowing it to move forward in a way of showing mutual understanding to actually get beyond and transform the challenges that we're going through together. We could turn somewhere else. We could turn somewhere else in order to get more relaxation. So I find that, for example, being in nature whenever possible, it would be the same time that I could use to sit in front of a television screen. If I could, you know, sit at a local park, if I could be somewhere else outside, taking in air, breathing, doing something with my hands, maybe knitting, maybe taking a nap. You know, there's all of these other things that one might do that could relax me more, that would then help me to be more energized in the social justice work that I'm doing. And so it seems to me that I want to challenge people to take a break from that kind of media, and not to get so defensive about why it's helping them, because, you know, that kind of holding on to it, there's something that seems kind of funny there when we start getting into these conversations and there's a lot of defensiveness around how much these shows and films mean to us versus just giving it an experiment of, you know, unplugging for a day, for a few days, even for a week. We're not saying forever, but just notice if you find yourself more relaxed at the end of that time. You know, maybe a little bit of nervousness might appear at the beginning, but I have a feeling that we'll get more relaxation and then we'll be stronger as we go into the work that we're doing. Because it's like we're giving ourselves these mixed messages. Yes, I want to fight for justice, but I'm, on the other hand, I'm watching shows that are promoting sexism, racism, classism, what have you. So, Michael?
Stephanie, you raised a really important point. It's a question I haven't really thought about in this particular way, and I'm going to pose it like this. What is really relaxing when we're sitting on that couch watching these dribbly, no-content, feel-good shows? What's being relaxed is our sense of judgment, our sense of responsibility, our sense of agency. And you are so right. When we relax those things, it actually adds to greater tension. And I'm going to accept what you said about going for a walk in the woods and raise you one. If you're playing.
Not everybody has woods available to walk in, so I want to just say, give that as an example. But, you know, you find your own space of peace in the environment that you're in, and might be just talking with your neighbors. And
well, it could. I mean, I want to actually raise the stakes on that a little bit, and I think
go ahead.
I think if you do meaningful work in the right spirit, there's a very deep peace and relaxation that comes from that. And the right spirit, you know, we gave a whole weekend seminar on this down in Mount Madonna Center. The right spirit is to choose the right task, use the right means, and finally, and most importantly, be detached from the results. Mm-hmm. Incredibly good things have been happening around Meta recently. And one of my good friends told me yesterday in a hangout we were having, Michael, you've got to be detached from the results. And I said, Frank, call me up every morning and remind me of that, will you? Because contrary to what we're being told by these agency-less media, I mean, I remember a television debate, a presidential debate one time. And when the debate was over between the two candidates, somebody came out and said, we'll have the results for you in a minute. In other words, if you thought you were there to make up your own mind, think again. The network is going to tell you who won and who lost on this debate. So when we're watching stuff like that, something inside us is actually quite concerned, is actually quite bothered. Mm-hmm. And when we exercise our deeper faculties in the right spirit, we get a much deeper relaxation.
Yeah, that's really, Michael, we'd never have had this conversation before. I'm happy that it's happening in front of a live audience, in front of all
our going to be even more alive by the time
friends and community, because the that question of what's being relaxed is, as you said, our agency.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep.
Just to, you know, to think about that, I would agree with that because I also indulge in pointless media from time to time. So I'm not saying that I'm beyond it, but I'm saying that I'm also trying to understand what's going on when I'm turning toward it and experimenting with another way whenever I have the willpower to do so.
Yeah, and whenever you use your willpower in that way, you get a little more of it. It's something that grows through use like a muscle. You know, Mickey brought up this question that we're very fond of, the question of restorative justice. In the earliest days of restorative justice, when it was much less sophisticated and much less widespread than it is now, prison people discovered that, and this was counterintuitive, that's why I like it so much, they discovered that one of the things that you could do to help an offender, a convict, to start on the road to recovery was to take responsibility for what he or she had done.
Hmm.
Because something inside us is very nervous when we shirk responsibility and deprive ourselves of our sense of agency.
Mm-hmm.
So on the road to recovery, the first thing is to say, yes, I did this. Let's look at the reasons why, and let's look at the way out.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually, in a sense, you could say that was very relaxing for these people because they were being treated like unresponsive, agency-less brutes, really, and that was a very anxiety-producing state for them. It's been shown that a lack of self-respect is the major stimulus for violent behavior. If you have to pick one thing, it would be that. And here are people being given a very degrading message that you have no agency. So we might think, oh my gosh, you know, don't make them face what they did. But actually, to do that is the first step in regaining self-respect.
Okay. All right. From that, I want to make one more point.
Okay.
About the media and our use of it. And there are some people who feel that sort of, you know, the same way that we talk about alcohol and smoking and so forth, they say, oh, I just do it socially, or I have this under control. It doesn't matter. But the point is that even if you have it under control, you're supporting an industry that's working to make others suffer. You
and
know,
you're seeing, yes.
and to provide a false reality to people. So not everybody has the skills that you might have, but why support the industry that's there to make others less than secure, less than happy in their lives in order to, you know, support a world that you don't want to live in?
Another terrific point, Stephanie, because what that actually means is when you do that, when you say, okay, this doesn't hurt me, so
right.
I'm going to do it,
right.
You're alienating yourself from others. You're cutting yourself off from your responsibility towards your fellow human beings.
Or you start by saying, oh, it doesn't hurt people that much. You know,
yeah.
It really is not, you know, we're in this kind of media denial. And so speaking of media denial, our new Emergence magazine that just relaunched is coming out at the Meta Center. You can find out more at our website, metacenterwith2ts.org, is on nonviolence and new media. And so, Michael, why don't you give us kind of a sneak preview of if this were a nonviolent society that we lived in, you know, nonviolence in the news would be just the news.
Yeah.
So tell us, so what's the news? Like, tell us, let us live in the world that we would like to be in.
Wonderful. There's so much good stuff going on.
Well, you're out of time. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry.
Don't do that to me. I like to start off, as you know, Stephanie, with some cultural media rather than events. And there's a journal called Peace Review, which is very worthwhile. And the forthcoming issue is on neo-extractivism, the exact form that's being taken by the extractive industries and the resistance to them. And instead of focusing solely on the negative impact, I'm quoting from their own description here. The issue intends to examine ways that communities and their allies are responding. Throughout Central, South, and North America, India, Australia, Southeast Asia, and Africa. That's pretty much the globe. Continuing the quote, inventive campaigns include the sophisticated use of new communications, such as geospatial technologies to map the problem and the response, video documentaries to publicize local stories of resistance and renewal, and communications networks which ally local, indigenous, and environmental movements. New local, regional, and transnational legal strategies are being used, in which communities are undertaking community referenda, people's tribunals, and calls for changes in rich countries such as Canada and the U.S. So that will be a wonderful window onto things that are going on, that are succeeding, and which the corporate media is very unlikely to tell you about. Another similar thing just happened at the UN, and I'm very happy about this one because a good friend of ours, Mel Duncan, who's been on this program, was intimately involved in getting this to happen, and also former Ambassador Chowdhury from Bangladesh. There's a UN high-level peace operations panel. And you know, to simply put, the issue here is, can the UN transition from armed peacekeepers to unarmed civilian peacekeeping? And we're starting to hear the answer, yes. Unarmed strategies is item number 84. And they say, and I quote, unarmed strategies must be at the forefront of UN efforts to protect civilians. Mm. So that's official.
And they're working a lot with the European Union in mm-hmm. terms of the work of NP as well, I believe, of Nonviolent Peace Force. And it just makes me think about the way that in order to participate as a member country in the EU, you have to renounce the death penalty.
Right.
Wouldn't it be a wonderful prospect to think of, mm-hmm. you know, the next level of that is to renounce armed?
Yeah. Instead of the TPP, how about forming a North American Union with higher ethical standards than we have? For example, right now in Japan, there's a controversy because Prime Minister Shinzo Abe wants to basically revoke Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, which forbids Japan from entering into foreign military action. It should the Japanese Army, Navy, so forth, the military is mandated to serve only as a defensive force. And Prime Minister Abe wants to change that, and we know who's pressuring him into that. Well, there was recently a very well-organized protest of 30,000 people saying, keep our article, keep our constitution, don't make these new security changes. So extremely interesting development there. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I was talking with a Japanese friend in Tokyo, and she was asking me, what can we do about this? And I said, what's going to make it work is if you have something that goes beyond just saying, we will not do this kind of fighting, but goes on to say, we will do another kind of fighting. And that Japan could develop the same kind of global civilian war service, peacekeeping service, I mean, that has been developed in Germany, which basically employs unarmed civilian peacekeeping. Mm. If they had that as an alternative, there wouldn't just be this very nervous-making sense of deprivation, but there would be something else that they would be able to do. So that's where Constructive Program and the meta banner of Constructive Program that we're always waving comes in. Now, to turn to some very local news, and this is kind of the nostalgia section of today's report. If you're my age, you might remember the Golden Rule. I don't mean the one that says, do unto others as you do, as you would have them do to you. I don't even mean the ironic Golden Rule that states that he who has the gold makes the rules. But rather, there was a 34-foot catch called the Golden Rule, which sailed into the Eniwetok nuclear test site with Alfred Hassler and others aboard. It was a wonderful act of interposition in the early days of developing nonviolent resistance to nuclearism, Well, 5 years ago, the Golden Rule, the ship, the boat, was discovered at the bottom of Humboldt Bay. And I'm happy to say that this historic peace boat will once again sail the seas, thanks to volunteers who've donated thousands of hours of labor and love. It's just about ready. Please consider a splashdown gift, they're saying. And I did state briefly that the Seattle protests against Shell, against Royal Dutch Shell, have been very successful in every way except the technical fact of totally preventing the sailing of the rig up north. It was a beautifully organized campaign, which got lots and lots of publicity, and I'm happy to say did lots and lots of training. So you come out of this event, whether you win or lose, with a more sophisticated and better trained public ready to take on the next one. And this is really thrilling, because what's been the problem in the peace movement ever since has been all events have been treated as one-offs, and there hasn't been continuity, there hasn't been building of momentum. If you want to find out more about this, get in touch with John Sellers and the other 98%. He started one of the people started the Ruckus Society, so he knows about training.
What I like about that campaign the best is that they really have Mother Earth on their side. So, you know, how can you go wrong?
Right. Yeah, that is one powerful ally. Mm-hmm. So in my hometown of New York City, in a vote that took place Monday night after 16 months of student pressure, this is firmeza permanente. You know, this is what it takes. You need to be flexible as to techniques, but very, very determined as to the continuity of your efforts. So after 16 months of student pressure, Columbia University's Board of Trustees voted to divest its endowment from private prisons. I feel very good about this, because private prisons is a regression to the 17th century, and it's extremely barbaric. And that endowment, by the way, guess how much money was involved here? We're talking about, you guessed it, Stephanie, $9.2 billion. Mm-hmm. So this will create a screen that will prevent further investments of this type down the line. Campaign was led by Columbia Prison Divest, or CPD, which is a part of the Black-led campus group, Students Against Mass Incarceration. I'm also against mass incorporation, but Students Against Mass Incarceration. So this is a different wing of the restorative justice angle that we're trying to promote that will really make a deep impact, I think, on the current prison system.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a little story on that note, which at the Meta Center, we have a thought for the day called Daily Meta that you know, it goes through a quote from Gandhi and explains that in context of nonviolence today, or a story about Gandhi. It's very entertaining. And then an experiment in nonviolence. And the one from the other day was about this gentleman, Wiyan, from Texas, or from Bangladesh, who was studying in Texas. And he was working at a convenience store post 9/11. For a few days after that, a gentleman, Mark Stroman, comes in and shoots him with a double barrel shotgun and in the face, and leaves him for dead. And what happens is that he doesn't die, and ends up taking a Hajj, a pilgrimage to Mecca, and realizing the deeper experience of Mark Stroman, who's now on death row in Texas, comes back to the United States and campaigns to free him from death row. And, you know, but this is Texas, so that's going to be a really hard battle, because there's a lot of politics mixed up with the death penalty in Texas. And but his forgiveness, his act of forgiveness for Stroman, was a letting go of the resentment that was keeping him isolated in order that he might make more transformative change in the world by, you know, opening himself up to this, to the potential for what this relationship with this person who had harmed him, who wanted him to die, could do. And Stroman ends up totally transforming, even though he's still going to, you know, experience execution, calling him his brother. He called Bouillon his brother, and he also told him that he loves him. And that he understood the roots of his behavior in a way that he had never understood before. And just as Bouillon is a voice in the fight to help people to engage in the discussion around the death penalty, engage in the discussion around racial hatreds and forgiveness, in that strong sense of the word of how to use forgiveness in terms of a way to deepen the struggle for justice together. I think that Stroman could have also have been a very important voice in that way of speaking out against the groups that he was a part of, helping people to transition out of them because he had the experience of being in them. So he had been transformed. But the prison system that we had that you were just talking about doesn't allow that to happen, because he was executed before he could. So I think that we were saying that in that idea that we really need a prison system or a system of justice that is relevant to the image of the human being that's emerging now, that we have a better understanding of it.
In other words, the fact that any human being can redeem him or herself, and we seem to not being honoring that at all. I remember when the German government wanted to put up a museum next to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, showing you, hey, modern Germany isn't like that, and we wouldn't let them do it. I think that's one of the most damaging things that we're doing. Well, Stephanie, I don't know how much time we have left, but
You have 1 minute left, Michael, okay. So why don't you give us one more piece of nonviolence in the news that would leave us on a very happy note?
Okay.
Can you do it?
I can do
all
that.
Right.
I wanted to start with a little quote from a junior at Columbia in the protests that I was just talking about. Her name is Asha Rosa. And it's a very interesting insight into how these grassroots protests happen. She said, quote, "At some point, we all just started saying, we're going to make it happen before we graduate." And so we did. Isn't that nice? Similarly, the flotilla that is leaving for Gaza, a chair of the European Campaign to End the Siege of Gaza, a man named Mazen Kahil, said, "We send a message of love and peace for the Gazans. We won't be intimidated by threat. We will continue at any cost."
Well, Michael, thank you so much for your nonviolence in the news. And I want to thank everybody for listening to Peace Paradigm Radio today. Thank you to everybody at the Meta Center, to our mother station, KWMR, here in beautiful Point Reyes Station, to you, all of our listeners. And if you'd like to hear, if you're listening on the web and you want Peace Paradigm Radio in your local town, get in contact with us and we can help make that happen. Until the next time, everybody, take care of one another and analyze the media that you are receiving. And if you need some nonviolence, come visit Meta. Thanks a lot.